Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did humans first dream of circling the globe, and what has been the cost of that ambition in money, in social and environmental impact, and in human lives? My guest today has carefully studied the nearly 500-year history of travel around the planet, which she says was first colored by fear, then by confidence, and now with a renewed sort of doubt as to whether such globetrotting is truly safe for people or good for the planet. Joyce E. Chaplin is James Duncan Phillips, professor of early American history at Harvard University. Her new book is called Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. Joyce, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks so much, Chris.
Given that such a tiny fraction of people will actually undertake a journey around the entire planet in one go, talk about what makes circumnavigation such an important key to understanding human history.
Well, it's the longest human activity that we have that was done on a planetary scale. I mean, there are a lot of other things that we now do on a planetary scale, most of them recently developed. And there were a lot of different kinds of travel that humans undertook, but the tradition, and it is one, of going around the world has lasted for 500 years. So for that long, we really have thought of ourselves on a planetary scale.
So that makes it seem sort of ludicrous when we talk about ourselves now as a suddenly global society, doesn't it?
It does a bit. Global means social relations that we have with people around the world. And in distinction to that, I would say that going around the world is planetary because that's physical. That's the physical planet that we compare ourselves to. So the globalization really has come quite recently and has really built itself on that longer planetary tradition. So it's not all new.
It was interesting. You were surprised to discover that few historians had really delved into this subject of circumnavigation directly. What do you think accounts for that?
Actually, it's very surprising. It's actually evidence that there are a lot of great topics that historians just haven't gotten to. And this was one of them, maybe because of the scale, 500 years, and then the entire Earth looked at over a long period of time. And that may not have seemed like the best idea for someone to take on as a research project.
So you discovered, or I should say rediscovered, Jules Verne a few years ago while you were on an ocean voyage yourself. What made Around the World in 80 Days resonate for you well over a century after it was first published?
The idea that you could go around the world within that period, 80 days, as if that would be incredibly quick. And of course, now that seems really, really long to us. Because I really had worked on earlier periods of history, 17th and 18th century, that 80-day measure seemed very quick from that perspective. So I was really interested in, well, what historic moment did that represent, 80 days? So that's how I became interested in how people have done it, how new technology sped them up, made it a lot faster with steam power, for instance, and then how people now look back on that slower way of looking at the Earth and seeing that as a good thing.
Yeah, it seems almost as if Verne's tale was written during a sort of sweet spot for this sort of travel, at least for Westerners. There was this combination of European imperialism and technological advances in transportation so that it was fairly easy, fairly safe to travel around the Earth.
And again, as you said, for Westerners, so for anyone protected by imperialism, particularly the British Empire, those social connections that were really bound around the world made it easy for certain kinds of travelers for transit through a lot of different territories that would not be easy now. And then the technology, the steam power, the creation first of the Suez Canal in 1869, and then the Panama Canal early in the 20th century meant that you could go around the world in a steamship quite quickly.
Of course, that ability to travel with ease had been won by earlier voyagers and imperialists who set out knowing they were less likely to return to their point of origin than to die trying.
That was a real surprise of the project, just the horrendous mortality rates for the circumnavigations in the age of sail. So Magellan sets out with about 275 men, and only 35 come back. That's an 86% death rate, only one of five ships. And those kind of attrition rates remain standard until the end of the 18th century. So a lot of people try to take on the planet. They know they can do it, at least some of them, but in most cases, the planet just, as if it were, it shrugged them right off.
Hmm. So before Magellan, how and when did people first start thinking seriously about the prospects for circumnavigation? And before they actually attempted it, what stopped people from making the try?
I don't think anyone felt like they had a reason to do it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Magellan didn't think he was going to do it. He sets out from Spain intending to sneak up on Portuguese trading in the Spice Islands, what we would now call Indonesia, and probably expected that he would go back the same way he had come. It's only after Magellan had died, his survivors actually make it across the Pacific Ocean and to Indonesia, and they realize they've gone around most of the world. Why go back? So I just don't think people had thought that it was a necessary or desirable thing to do before. And it's really only after Magellan crosses the Pacific, kind of gives a sense of its size and how it separates the Americas from Asia, that people then begin planning on doing that.
Why is Magellan's name today synonymous with a feat that he did not achieve himself?
I call him the most famous man who never went around the world. and I think expeditions are often known by their commander's name. And so Magellan initiates the expedition, though he had not intended to go around the world. And the person who gets overlooked in all of this is the man who brings the one ship back, Sebastian del Cano. So hyper-correctly, we should call the expedition the Magellan-El Cano expedition, but I think people find it just easier to say Magellan.
Can you explain for us, Joyce, what made those earliest journeys so perilous? I mean, I think we can sort of imagine that everything was hard when you were on a wooden ship and counting on the wind to get you where you were going, but talk about the specific threats along the way.
The wooden ships were good for many things, and cartography, navigation, some elements of ship design are all really improving at this time, but the wooden ships are lousy life support systems. It's just very hard to fill them with enough food and fresh water that is going to last, especially across the Pacific Ocean, that's really only one bad part of an immensely long journey. It isn't until the end of the 18th century that there's a real science in what you pack. What do human beings need to be at sea for a very long period of time? And before that was really worked out and before people knew exactly where they could safely make landfall, where they could get food and water, where they wouldn't be attacked, before all of that, it's a marathon and everything is against you.
And even if sailors were still alive, they could be sufficiently debilitated by illness that they couldn't really get their work done.
The big killer was scurvy, which is just this terrible disease where you suffer from what we now would recognize as a deficiency of vitamin C. It wasn't understood that way at the time. All people knew is that it made you fall apart physically. You would lose strength. Old wounds on your body would reopen. It's like watching a film run in reverse. And eventually, people are too weakened even to do work, or if they make the exertion to try, that will kill them. So once crews have lost enough men, and once too many men are too weak to do the work, that's a very dangerous situation, because then the ship may veer off course. It may not make the port that it desperately needs to. It could crash into something. So that creeping debility of scurvy is really the most dangerous part.
Tell us a little bit about the process of navigating places that had never before been documented on maps.
It's astonishing that people could actually do this. When Magellan goes across the Pacific Ocean, he misses every form of land from the Strait of Magellan, named for him, until he hits Guam. And so they were really navigating blind, as it were, charting stars they had never really seen in the Southern Hemisphere, watching for land and islands that they would only learn about for the first time. It was amazingly bad for them that they didn't encounter any inhabited land, because the peoples of Polynesia are some of the most sophisticated navigators on Earth, and it really would have helped to have some contact with them and what they knew.
So not only could they have gotten information, they could have resupplied, a lot of things that would have made it more likely that a greater percentage of them would have survived the trip.
Yes, and it takes forever. It really isn't until the end of the 18th century when two things improve. First of all, this science of life support on wooden ships, but then also knowledge of where you can go to get food and water in the Pacific. And it's actually the latter thing that is the key. Once Europeans figure out the map of the world and they know where they can navigate to get food and water, and there are political arrangements to have free ports, that's what really makes it safer.
So, Joyce, these European explorers were certainly didn't lack for self-confidence and a sense that they sort of had the right to go around the planet, but they weren't stupid. I mean, what motivated individuals to take on these journeys and the governments and private agencies that would finance these trips, knowing that there was like an 80% to 90% chance that they wouldn't make it?
In a lot of cases, it's the monarch of a state calculating that this will be worthwhile. It's a way to sneak up on someone's empire. It's a way to be a predator on somebody else's trade. So a lot of the first early circumnavigators, Magellan, Drake, Cavendish, are more or less pirates. they really are going around the world for not quite business is not quite on the up and up. And it would be worthwhile in certain instances to back such an expedition, because you could get in on some very valuable form of trade, or as Drake did, Francis Drake just took silver and any other kind of valuables from the Spanish Empire. Later on, it does seem to be the case that it becomes a kind of prestigious thing to do. So by the end of the 1600s, we can kind of see people beginning to brag, I've been around the world. And clearly that's a very small club. So claiming that you belong to that seems to take on a life of its own. And we still see this today, this kind of us too mentality. My nation can also do this kind of around the world venture, or me too, I can go on this kind of trip. But that goes back to the 1600s.
The early explorers eagerly read one another's accounts of their travels. What kind of information, inspiration were they looking for?
It is interesting that even though a lot of these early sailors are national competitors, Spain doesn't get along with England, etc., but in a lot of the circumnavigators' accounts, there's an emphasis placed on providing a kind of map of the world in terms of its usable resources. You can find fresh water here. You can find food here. And it's seen as really bad form to lie or withhold information, even if it might be information your competitors use. Again, I think there was a recognition that this is such a deadly practice that why not give a little help to people who are going to come in your wake?
Like there's enough already that is in the way of people who want to do this that you're not really going to challenge. In other words, they're not going to get in your way just because you gave them a little information.
No, exactly. The handicaps are such that, again, it would be bad form to know that you would send people to their deaths because you didn't tell them where the fresh water was.
Joyce E. Chaplin is my guest. She's James Duncan Phillips Professor of Early American History at Harvard and author of the new book Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. You can be part of the conversation by calling us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You're also welcome to send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with James Duncan Phillips, professor of early American history at Harvard, Joyce E. Chaplin. Her new book is called Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Joyce, for a project like this one, what's the difference between the kind of information that you can glean from primary sources as compared with even contemporary third-party accounts?
Oh, gosh, Chris, great question. Both would be primary sources. The book mostly relies on the first-person narrative of a circumnavigator. I went around the world. This is how I did it. This is what I saw. Sometimes the third-party accounts from the same period of time are interesting, though. And so I use both, in essence. But I was mostly interested in how there is actually a written tradition of how you write a circumnavigator's account, what needs to be there. So, for instance, crossing the international dateline, as we would call it, is a centerpiece of the circumnavigator's experience, and that really becomes a kind of ritual of going around the world that everyone writes about, and that's eventually represented in drama and film later on.
And were media accounts from the time, I mean, were they always very, were they cheering these people on? Were they critical? Were they questioning sort of the value of these excursions?
There isn't much questioning of them for a long time. We get the first newspaper accounts as, you know, periodicals in the 18th century, and they're mostly marveling or admiring. Again, it's such a dangerous thing to do. There's a lot at stake. If there's commentary by periodicals in the Nation of the people in question, you know, there's a patriotic element very, very strongly embedded. And then into the 19th century, when you see the emergence really of a kind of a stunt circumnavigation, people who bicycle around the world, who women who go alone, again, a lot of the newspaper accounts are admiring. And after the telegraph, you know, when newspapers pick up stories over the wire, often people know a circumnavigator is coming. So the first guy who bicycles around the world, you know, he meets people. He'll arrive somewhere, like in Japan, and they say, oh, we've been following you. So I think into the 19th century and maybe the early 20th century, there's still a kind of heroic idea about how to do it that really that's lasted quite a long time.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Brandon in Dallas. Hi, Brandon.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing today?
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Doing all right. I just had a comment. One of my points of pride in my heritage is the fact that the Norse had circumnavigated the globe several times over, you know, like, they had the first trade route into the Middle East before most of the other European nations or peoples or even tribes did. And there's documented cases of Norse just accidental falling into certain places. Like there's documented cases of one group who landed over in California, actually, just on accident. And another case falling down into South Texas, there's a cave in Oklahoma where this Norseman died, and he's got all his runic script all over this cave where the tribes let him live.
I should point out here, I have Swedish ancestry, so I share that pride. but as a historian, I've got to say, you know, the Norse did amazing long-distance voyages, but there's no evidence that they actually made technically a circumnavigation, which means crossing each line of longitude going in the same direction. And the first historical evidence that we have of somebody doing that is the Magellan-Elcano expedition that concludes in 1522. So there had been a lot of really impressive long-distance travel that went on before, but not that entire planetary circle, which is more recent.
So when we get to this period that you say started by the late 18th century of sort of confidence in global travel, beyond the technology, what socially allowed many people to feel confident in their ability to sort of move about the planet as they chose?
Well, imperialism is still very, very helpful to Europeans and to white people from other colonized parts of the world. So if you have a passport from a Western nation, that is incredibly helpful. You need money. It gets cheaper over time, but it still helps to have either your own funds, or sometimes some of these circumnavigators set up an arrangement with a newspaper where they will send in stories and get paid. So you are free to do this, and the cost is going down. But as is true now, it really helps to have a certain kind of status and passport, and you can't be broke. It can't be done.
And I suppose there was a point at which this became literally a status symbol, and there were tour companies set up to allow people just to do this for the fun of it.
For the fun of it, exactly. And that was a very new idea. It had been so difficult to do it before, and it remains pretty hard even in the 19th century when even a lone traveler going around the world would describe that as an expedition using that kind of old military idea. But by the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century, professional tour guides and shipping companies will set up very luxurious ways to do this. So around the world cruises. I don't think there's been any era like the 19-teens and 20s for doing it in style with all the champagne that you can drink. And that was a very different development, that it would be the most luxurious thing you might do in your life to go around the world. That's very, very privileged, and that costs a lot of money.
Was that kind of availability of privileged traveling the thing that motivated people to want to do this on foot, on, you know, snow skis, and in part on bicycles?
Well, you don't get famous by doing it on a cruise liner. I mean, the cruise liners do by setting up this unprecedented kind of service. But the stunt circumnavigators, the doing it some hard or unusual way, they want in some ways to have some impact, to get their name known. And that's a very different motivation to being able to purchase the experience and to do it in a kind of privileged luxury.
You know,
we still have both of those going on.
And learning about all that made me think about now this sort of dawning age of space tourism. And the first few people who did this as tourists indeed did get famous, but at some point in the near future, that may not be the case at all.
Right. Once it becomes too common, people don't care. There is a way in which going around the world now has become a set of records. The first to do it this way, the first to do it that way. It's become too easy to do it an ordinary way. And anytime it does become easy, flying around the world used to be incredibly difficult and potentially fatal. Now, who cares, unless you do it, say, in some unusual aircraft? That might be true of space travel as well. Not very many space tourists, as they're called, have done a full orbit. Not a lot of the space tourism that's being projected would take people into orbit. You'd go up, you'd come down. Going into orbit costs a lot more, just because of the fuel costs to bring somebody up and down. So we'll see.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak next with Richard in Fort Worth. Hi, Richard.
Hello. I had a comment. There's a race out of France called the Vendée Globe. It started in the 60s, and it's a 20 single-handed, nonstop sailboat race around the world. And I think typically about a third of the sailors finish. And they started out with 20, and they're already lost 7 boats to running into debris and other boats and things. But
so
just a point of interest.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I talk about the Vendée Globe in my later chapters. This is an around-the-world solo, unassisted sailing race that throws in a circumnavigation of Antarctica just to kind of keep things lively. It is a very expensive and hard to achieve kind of thing. So professional sailors do it with a lot of corporate backing because it's so expensive to have a campaign, as it's called. And, you know, good luck to them. It's an amazingly grueling kind of circuit. And as the gentleman just mentioned, very, very few people actually complete it.
So did these, I mean, these travelers during the Age of Confidence had this sense that they had perhaps dominion over their fellow human beings and there were, you know, colonial holdings throughout the world. Did they also have a sense that they were gaining control of the planet itself, that somehow the elements were no longer as deadly as they once had been?
Definitely. That increased sense of confidence radiates throughout everything that circumnavigators are doing. And they are going around the world at a time when it's perceived that technology is literally girdling the globe. And people talk about that even before it actually does it, but there's an expectation, for instance, that the telegraph will make a literal circuit around the world, and eventually it does by the early 20th century, but people are talking about that even earlier. There's a sense as well that between them, railroads, so steam engines on land, and then steamships at sea create a kind of technological circuit that goes all around. The 19th century is also kind of the first period when people begin to visualize things in terms of their going around the world. How many times would a newspaper have to go around the world, or copies of a book, or coins? How many pennies would it take to go around the world? So there was that literal imagination of the things that people create actually girdling the globe.
That's so fascinating, because now we hear these descriptions all the time, or we hear about, you know, would stretch to the moon and back four times or something.
Yes, the lunar unit has replaced this going around the world to a certain extent and has become the new litmus of how powerful human technology might be, though people still use around the world as well.
Not much anxiety during this time over the role of new technology in the way that today we have these wonderful new things, we celebrate them, and then at the same time we're wringing our hands over what they're doing to us.
I think the hand-wringing has increased over time. You can see it sometimes in the 19th century. Some of the American transcendentalists, for instance, were kind of skeptical that human technology should girdle the globe. What would that accomplish? What would that actually mean? In his novel Moby Dick, Melville also echoes this and says, "Round the world, you know, what would all that circumnavigation mean?" So there are those doubts, but I think it's much more apparent to us now how our creation of a built environment, that human construction, reconstruction of the world, may have a really significant downside.
You alluded earlier to the first women to try to do this on a solo basis. I suppose this kind of travel wasn't really available to women until we reached this Age of Confidence. Is that right?
Exactly. Incredibly, the first female that we know went around the globe was a goat. It tells you a lot about how sailors did not like to take women to sea, let alone around the world. So it's a milk goat that is assigned by the Royal Navy to two circumnavigating vessels. She actually does the first circumnavigation by a female and then the second. And women don't really go until the 19th century. There is one human female who goes around the world in the late 18th century, another one who goes in the early 19th century, but it doesn't become common until the middle or late 19th century. Because, again, you need commercial travel services. Most navies are not interested in carrying civilians of any kind, let alone females. So it isn't until you get commercial vessels that say, sure, we'll take any paying passenger, that women really have a chance to do this.
Are women's accounts, those early women's accounts, strikingly different from those of the men who were sort of in charge of the voyages?
The first two women who go around the world don't publish their accounts. One doesn't write anything that we can find, and the other writes letters that are never published in her lifetime, because that would have been shocking. So the first really sustained account comes from this woman from Vienna, a widow, Ida Pfeffer, who goes around the world twice. And she does dwell on how tough it is if you're female. She wears men's clothing. She carries pistols. She is very careful about what she does. And she also leans very, very hard on European imperial power. So she makes it clear just the circumstances that are absolutely necessary for her to be able to do this in a way that probably a man wouldn't do that in his account.
So how did we get to the point where we have sort of entered an age of doubt about all this? Because in some ways, traveling today is as easy as it has ever been. It is as safe as it has ever been. We can get around the planet essentially in an airplane in a matter of days, if not hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, aviation is pretty safe now. When it was first done, I mean, when the first aerial circumnavigations were being done in the early 20th century, planes were pretty dangerous. So the first aerial circumnavigation was completed in 1924 by a team. The U.S. Army Air Corps sent out four airplanes with two men apiece. Only two of those airplanes make it back, and only three of the teams. And that was a very clever way to do it, because having these four planes made it more likely that at least one would make it back. Mm. It remains pretty dangerous and hard to do. Some of the early aerial circumnavigations were, in fact, not full circles of the globe. They were done in the northern hemisphere, so that's shorter than an actual circle that would be the equivalent of the equator. The first person to try to do that equivalent of the equator is Amelia Earhart. She wants to set the mileage record, and that is, of course, the famous flight during which she dies. So that's evidence that this is still pretty tough to do. And that sense of danger really changed and challenged that confidence that had been building up in the 19th century. Even as aviation got safer, then we get into the era of space travel, where, again, that seems very forbidding, incredibly expensive. You have to be selected out of a kind of military set of personnel for the first space ventures, and that also seems pretty dangerous. So the confidence erodes a little bit more there, too.
We'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes with Joyce E. Chaplin, James Duncan Phillips, professor of early American history at Harvard and author of the new book Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program and Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joyce E. Chaplin. She's James Duncan Phillips, professor of early American history at Harvard and author of the book Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So Joyce, as you sort of teased us with in the last segment, you have the mid-20th century, you have the dawn of the era of space travel, which brings with it so much promise and so much peril.
Right. And an element as well of national rivalry during the Cold War, secrecy, limited publicity. So a lot of kind of revival of that national glamour to making a certain kind of circumnavigation, but revival as well of the dangers.
And when you talked about the U.S. Army Air Corps sending multiple aircraft to circumnavigate the globe, something similar happened in the early days of space travel. We thought, let's try animals first and see how that goes.
Right. No one was going to send up a human, first of all. So, interestingly, the Soviet space program used dogs, and the U.S. space program, NASA, used primates. Mm-hmm. There's a real national difference in preference. And it wasn't until capsules and rockets had been tested on either dogs or primates, and then a variety of other smaller animals that humans were sent up. In the Soviet case, Yuri Gagarin, the first man to orbit the Earth, followed by the first woman a little bit further on, Valentina Tereshkova. The first American, of course, was John Glenn.
What changed when we had a view of the Earth from space?
I don't think Yuri Gagarin had thought that he was going to set out a kind of tradition that as you orbit or go into orbit, you look back at the Earth and admire it. Gagarin was busy giving a kind of report on the equipment. You know, that was his job. This is working, that is working. Then he catches a view of the Earth and he said, "It's beautiful. What beauty." And everyone pretty much does that, both the Soviets and the U.S. And then eventually a lot of other different nationalities have remarked that seeing the world in orbit and eventually seeing it from the moon is just amazing, just amazing. And eventually, there would be these descriptions of people saying, "Oh my gosh!" And then eventually there would be photographs that gripped the public imagination and showed that, you know, the astronauts weren't exaggerating. There was really something astonishing. I think, however, you know, this builds on that tradition of a sense of human connection to the planet that had always been there in different eras of circumnavigation. Qualitatively, there's something going on in the space age that's a little bit different, but it builds on that tradition of human engagement with the planet.
And I guess there's also this sense that, you know, the Earth can look beautiful but fragile from a distance, and then one who is disconnected from it must feel quite fragile, quite vulnerable.
I think that's part of it. There's great commentary from the Soviet cosmonauts on one of the early Soviet space stations, that they talk about how when they dream of Earth. They think of specific rivers and woods. As the planet revolves, they try to find different places, like where they're from. So they always feel drawn back to it with that sense. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, Chris, that you feel fragile and you perceive that the planet is fragile as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone with Stephanie in Dallas. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering what all your guests could tell us about the earlier Chinese explorers. There's one in particular. His name is Stephen. I think it's spelled H-E.
Say hey.
Yes, and I know that there's some speculation that he may have come to the Americas before Columbus and had traveled quite a bit around the globe. Do you know if he made it all the way around?
Zheng He was an amazing Chinese navigator and did explorations that we know about into the Indian Ocean. So he sails, you know, down from China and then goes west and makes contact with Africa. There's no evidence that professional historians would accept that the Chinese went around the world, however. So again, I think that like the Norse voyagers that another caller asked about, the early Chinese expeditions got really impressively far. But going around the world, I think there's just no reason that they would have wanted to have done it at that time anyway.
Back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Leslie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, ladies. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, my question is in regards to the last caller about the Chinese traveling around the world. But my question actually is based on the book called 1421 by Galvan Mendez, which he had lots of evidence, and I didn't know if you read about that book or anything. And so, and I know that you had said something about what historians didn't believe in his evidence or something a second ago. So I was just questioning about that.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I mean, I teach at a university, so I know scholars of China who are professionally trained to work in archives, and they dismiss the idea that the Chinese did global travels beyond what we know that Zheng He did. This is not to say that evidence in future might not turn up, but so far it is not conclusive. It's very dramatic to claim that the Chinese went further than what we now know that they did, but that doesn't make it true.
I want to get back a little bit more to the current era. Talk about the ways that our sort of growing understanding of the social conditions around the planet end up being tied into our natural and scientific understanding of this planet and how our travel through it and across it might affect conditions here.
Well, there is a sense now that using anything with an internal combustion engine to get around the world is ipso facto not good for it. And so it's interesting that a lot of recent circumnavigations have been made using solar-powered ships or by using human energy. There was a two-person team that walked, bicycled, and rode their way around the world just to show that human power could take on the entire planet. So that's been a kind of new development where we question old technologies and how good they might be for the planet and propose that newer technologies like solar power might be equally powerful. So why not use them? There's a lot of around-the-world technology, and here I'll mention satellites, that generate information about how the planet is doing by circling it. So we have a lot of weather and scientific satellites, especially those in polar orbit. They go around and around, and as the world turns beneath it, they get a different shot every time. And this gives a lot of evidence about climate, about desertification of the planet, these are our proxy, our robot circumnavigators that tell us what shape the Earth is in.
And interestingly, those offer essentially incontrovertible evidence that the planet is changing. And yet, for many people, those are not incontrovertible evidence. They are questionable and things that ought to be debated.
Right. People are kind of selective. So they accept that satellites can help them make telephone calls and find things in their neighborhoods by using various kinds of satellite navigation systems, but they can also be very skeptical about what the same technology is doing in different versions to give us information about how the planet is actually not in very good shape. So you're right. There is skepticism from the public, not from the scientific community, where there's pretty near universal consensus that the information we get from satellites about a thinning ozone layer, about warmer temperatures, about more severe weather patterns are all signs that we're in trouble.
Anyone, Joyce, who loves to travel will say there is no substitute for being sort of on the ground in a place and experiencing it firsthand. On the other hand, we have all these technologies now that allow us to communicate. In the very near future, it may be possible for us to sort of virtually travel to places in a much more lifelike way than we've been able to do in the past. Do you think people will be less inspired to travel by these technologies, or will those, in fact, make people wish even more to be in the place that they're learning about?
I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, that would be a good way to see the world, and there might be a good way of crowdsourcing it. So people felt not only that they were seeing different parts of the world, but meeting other people.
Yeah.
And all kind of contributing to this way of showing, you know, children, people who don't have the time to travel or don't have the money to travel, they could see what they might actually see on the ground if they were literally during the journey. You know, that'd be a really fascinating experiment. If you were here right now, this is what you would be doing. You could then go on from there and find out what you'd be doing in another place. Mm-hmm. That could be very attractive. And it would in some ways be much more engaging than flying commercial aircraft around the world, making quick stops where you don't see as much.
Right. It's just at that point, it's just to be able to say that you've done it is essentially the reward.
Right, right. You need to really take time and stop in a lot of different places to begin to replicate the kind of experience that the first circumnavigators really had.
We have an email here from Mark who writes, I have circumnavigated the globe 3 times and will do so more proudly in the U.S. Merchant Marines.
Aha.
Mariners have a saying that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
That's a really great reminder. I'm grateful to whoever sent this in because we think now, I think those cruise lines in the early 20th century make us think now that going around the world is a kind of privileged experience. And again, I have said you need the money to do it. The very first circumnavigators, though, were all sailors, you know, poorly paid, maybe didn't actually sign up. And so this experience that we think of as being so glamorous was work for some people. That really remains the case for a lot of people in the armed forces, that professionally they see a lot of the world and they may make the most literal circuits around it. So that's another way of doing it.
And then that comment, the more things change, the more things stay the same. I mean, I suppose you could argue we are in the first cycle of this fear, confidence, doubt. Do you think, in fact, that the cycle could repeat itself?
And we could enter a new era of confidence. That would be very interesting. That would be, in a sense, a happy ending or a happier progression. It remains to be seen. I think we have a lot of problems to solve on Earth. It is wonderful that there was this long era of confidence in the 19th century, but there's a possibility that that may be the most atypical historical era that we've ever lived through, that mm-hmm. sense that we can continue to dominate the planet through technology. Maybe so, maybe not.
It was almost like maybe we believed that to be true until we educated ourselves enough to realize it was impossible, that we wouldn't cause damage.
Or we would have to really change the kind of technology we use and who uses it. So we'll see. I mean, the other scenario, I think the last phase, the last stage of around-the-world travel would be having a manned station on the moon.
Yeah.
Because the moon is the object that goes around the Earth all the time. If there were people on the moon for the full, almost month-long circuit, that would be the last stage. Anything beyond that would be qualitatively different. And that's where I really wonder how long it would take before we can say, well, Earth is fine, and now we can go explore the rest of the cosmos. That's going to be a very hard decision for us to make.
And it seems like it still is so distant. We like to imagine it, but we can't even think about sending people outside our own solar system at this point.
No. The technology for that just doesn't really exist in a form that would make me confident, for instance, that we could send people off to do that. So in the meantime, you know, we are on Earth, we go around it, and for better or worse, we're tied to it.
The new book by Joyce E. Chaplin is called Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. Joyce, so many interesting things to think about this hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. That was really fun.
Today's show was engineered by Alan Roberts. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can download the podcast and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.